I'm Kate.
And I'm Tolly.
And welcome to Wicked Within. This week we are back with the second part of our two-parter on the Frankie family and Jody Hildebrandt. And yes, that is the correct response. If you haven't listened to part one, go do that. We'll wait. Okay, thank you. Welcome back. Yeah. Yeah, so in part one, we discussed the lead up to the arrests of Jody Hildebrandt and Ruby Frankie. In this episode, we are going to backtrack even further to see how we got here. We're going to do some deep dives into Jody's methodologies with couples and how she seemed to make this connection with the Frankie family. And then we're going to discuss the events leading to Ars' escape from Jody's home and explore Jody's history of, quote, child therapy. And then we're also going to get into, like, a little bit of discussion about how Jody operates and if she's, like, vaguely cult leader-ish. Spoiler alert. Yes. Yeah. I think so.
Yep. You just got, like, culty vibes from the video.
Yeah.
Like, definitely a little brainwashy.
Definitely. Definitely. Without further ado, we are going to just dive in because this is probably going to be a rather lengthy episode.
Okay. Okay. I'm already annoyed.
Yes. You're going to get more annoyed. So again, asking the question, how did we get here? That is a long and very complicated story, and we're going to have to start by examining the relationship between Jody and Ruby. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, Jody was a licensed therapist. She received numerous referrals through the LDS Church, 12-step programs, and other addiction-related support groups, and she actually had a great reputation. I'm not entirely sure how she earned that reputation because her methods were not particularly conventional. According to some of Jody's previous clients, Jody would lull her clients into a false sense of security by just, you know, doing normal group or couples therapy kind of stuff, being really sweet. She was very charismatic, all that jazz. And then after she had earned their trust and convinced them that they needed to follow her directions with total obedience, everything would change. Group therapy sessions would start off as super supportive, understanding communities that they are supposed to be. But after a while, the tone would shift and the group sessions would turn into a semi-public shaming event.
Oh.
Yeah.
Jody, that is a very toxic relationship. That is like abuser mentality.
Yes, it is. It's very like troubling.
DV patterns.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you. Jody was a big proponent of accountability, which doesn't necessarily sound like a terrible thing on its own, but she saw every flaw and every setback as a personal moral failing. And then she wanted the other members of these groups to take it out on you or whoever, you know, had these failings or these setbacks or whatever in like this really public kind of shaming way. So,
oh my gosh.
That's not how they teach it in school. So don't do that. Yeah. Though Jody could be awful with her female clients, she seemed to be particularly horrible to her male clientele. Jody frequently drove wedges between couples and would lie to the wives during the female group sessions and tell them that their husbands had confessed to absolutely horrendous things that never actually happened.
What is her goal here?
I don't know, to be honest. And I'm hoping that after we have kind of reviewed this and then gone into more details about what she did in Ruby and Kevin's relationship, because we just have so much more information, I'm hoping that we'll be able to discuss it in more depth. Because I honestly don't know.
So far, she's like lulling these people into feeling like they can trust her, like implicitly trust her, because she is being professional up until a point where she's like, okay, I do feel like I have their complete buy-in. So now I'm going to start throwing stones and like emotionally and mentally breaking them down so I can manipulate them. And then I'm going to break up their marriages. Like what, for what? Like you're creating a vulnerable woman population to manipulate is what I'm getting from it.
Yeah, and a vulnerable male population to destroy, honestly.
Yeah. Like she has this very personal vendetta against men.
Yeah.
Because like she's not saying any of that stuff about the women. The women aren't committing these atrocities against their partners, are they?
I'm not necessarily sure. I did not. If she did do it to the women, she didn't do it as frequently. And I don't think that it ever turned into a personal vendetta in the same way that it did with men. Let's just – we'll keep going because I'll be curious to hear what you have to say after we learn even more. She would share what the husbands were saying in their group sessions with the wives, with their wives later on, which again, what the men said in their group sessions was supposed to stay confidential. And so then she went back and said stuff to the wives, although what she said wasn't even true. So – technically, maybe not.
She's just being so, like, gossipy in, like, the false way. Like, not even, like, giving actual – I mean, it's still gossipy because, like, not all gossip is true. Like,
yeah. Jody also shared private information about her clients with church elders, which is, as you can imagine, very illegal. Adam Steed and his then-wife received a referral to Jody through their church bishop. Adam had been sexually abused when he was a Boy Scout in Idaho in his youth, and he and numerous other victims had just settled a lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America. But it was still a stressy time. Adam still deals with the lingering effects of that trauma, and his wife had also faced some hardships in her youth. They had a young child and another one on the way, but all things considered, they were doing a pretty good job. They just struggled with those typical early marriage kind of issues. Adam and his wife started attending a couples counseling group led by Jody. Everything seemed so normal at first, and Jody really seemed like an incredible therapist. But as part of this counseling journey, Jody started to separate the men from the women, and that's when it really started to hit the fan. Adam started to see the blame and shame game, and he wanted to leave. And rather than just letting him go and find another therapist or just quit therapy like a normal person, Jody decided to lash out. Jody and Adam's then wife started conspiring together to accuse Adam of sexually abusing their child, which was particularly horrendous considering Adam's past and all of the work that he did to actually try to protect children. This coordinated attack ruined Adam's reputation, and he didn't have the strength or the energy to come forward until he saw something similar happen after Jody and Ruby were arrested. And Adam's experience wasn't unique, unfortunately. In 2012, Jody's license was suspended for 18 months after the licensing board confirmed these privacy violations. And Brigham Young University removed her from their list of recommended therapists in 2012 after that revocation. But for many of Jody's previous clients, the damage was already done. After 18 months, for some reason, unbeknownst to me, Jody's license was reinstated. And her career seemed to bounce back as though nothing had ever happened. In the same state? Yep. All in Utah because she's a Mormon.
I wonder, like, what that recertification process is. Like, do you get a remediation test? And they're like, all right, you're cured. You will obviously make the right choice this time.
I'm guessing that there has to be some sort of hearing or something along those lines that you have to attend, and maybe you try to explain yourself and talk about the steps that you are going to take to not let that happen again in the future.
Well, she's a very articulate, manipulative person. I'm sure she was able to say all the right things.
And I think that's exactly what it is. I think that she could easily make a board think that she was absolutely contrite about what she had done and that she was going to change her ways for the better without actually having any intention to do that. So. Yeah. When she was able to start practicing therapy again, Jody also added her new life coaching program, Connections. So now we've kind of seen the way that Jody has worked with other couples. Let's return our focus back to the Frankie family. Sometime between 2018 to 2020, Ruby and Kevin started seeing Jody. Based on an interview with Kevin, it sounds like they were looking for some family therapy due to some issues that they were having with one or more of their children. But Jody likes to focus on couples and have them fix their problems before focusing on the kids. I would generally want to see maybe a more collaborative approach where you work with both parents and their children.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not Jody, thank God. For the next part of the episode, I'm going to give a little narration interspersed with some clips from Kevin's second interview with the police, which took place after he had seen exactly what happened to his two youngest children. I could just give a narrative, as I often do, but this part of the story is so absolutely bonkers that I don't think that it would even sound believable if I tried to describe it. So I'm just gonna go ahead and let him do it.
Okay.
Jody always had a larger interest in communicating with the parents more than with the actual patient, which I always found curious. But her theory was, if you want to help your child, you have to help yourself first, and then you'll know how to help the child. So she spoke with Ruby frequently. It got strange around the fall of 2020. The Hannahs were trying to convince and bring Ruby into this organization called Connections, and that particularly were focused on things like lust versus love and healthy marriages, happier marriages, happier relationships. She invited me to go to a conference or something held at Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh. And my impression at that time was this is absolute craziness. This is a bunch of man-hating women that are just looking for excuses to tear down their husbands. And I mean, that's what it felt like to me when I was in there. It was confusing because there were people that I respected a lot that were up on the stage with microphones in hand, you know, giving testimonials of how great this was and how it changed their lives and their marriage, and like the Hannahs were among them, you know, and so it was confusing.
I normally give like a big eye roll to men who are like, these are just a bunch of men haters. No, this is a legit case of like triangulating against men who want, like, how many men do you know of genuinely want to go through the therapy process and like be involved in it to fix their relationship? Not many. And now that you're taking advantage of these men who genuinely want to put an effort into their relationship, and they are being attacked by a woman who is very purposely trying to separate this relationship so she can manipulate the wife.
I agree with you. I could not have said any of that better myself. I also would tend to be a little skeptical of the whole, like, oh, these are a bunch of man-hating women. I don't think that that is an inaccurate characterization.
Right.
I don't know what is happening within these families to make these women feel like maybe they have this lack of control, or they need to have this certain level of control over their husbands or what have you, or if that is purely Jody's influence or what is going on there. But I do not doubt him, because this is what other men say too. It's not just him. He is not the only man who's saying stuff like this. So
right.
You can kind of see, it almost feels like, you know, with the conference and everything like that, and he's like, and there were people up there who were talking about it. It feels like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
Or like a cult or something like that. So obviously we can see how Kevin was really skeptical, but there were these little things that just made him think, well, maybe this is actually what I need to do to make my marriage work, especially when there are other people who I know and who I respect who are saying that this has helped them. Kevin goes on to explain how he still felt like the whole situation was really off, but when he and Ruby had a heart-to-heart, she told him about how his behavior had really impacted their relationship. And Kevin cared about Ruby, and he cared about his family, so he decided to stick with the group counseling to see if he could fix his marriage. And for a while, it seemed to work. Though Kevin and Ruby were less intimate, they were also a lot happier. But then, Jody opened up about a little crisis that she was having in her life. And this is where the bonkers really,
okay,
really takes off.
We went out to like a dinner afterwards, and that's where Jody really opened up to the women in a private conversation that She believed she was being tormented and haunted by shadow figures every night. And that was spooky.
Spooky. That's a red flag. Like, if my therapist was like, I see shadow figures, I'm like, do you need to go to therapy? Do you need to get on medication?
I know.
Also, if my therapist was confiding in me for that information, I'd be like, I don't think I'm the right I think you should seek professional help because I don't think I'm the right one. I came to you.
Yeah.
I have issues.
Yeah. And apparently, so do you.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't think that anybody, like, when you're first starting out on this case, you don't think, oh, there's going to be some weird paranormal element of this case.
No.
There is.
This is a true crime case, right? Like, that's how we started.
That's how we started, and that's where we're going to end. But in the little, in the middle, it gets a little messy. So.
Okay.
A couple of Jody's clients decided to take her in while she tried to fight the devil or whatever she was doing, but that didn't last long, and I'm going to let Kevin explain why it didn't last long.
I have a Michael Scott face.
According to Jody, she was held against her will for 6 weeks and was kidnapped, and she escaped and got out. According to the Hannahs, after 6 weeks of Jody stabbing herself with forks and knives, cutting herself, and wanted to commit suicide and trying to seduce the husband of the family, they kicked her out. I don't know what's the truth. Maybe a little bit of both. I don't know. But the point is, somewhere around mid-April, Jody was back in her home in Ivins, and she was a hot mess.
Wherever you expect this story to go, it just, it's like, nah, I'm we're taking a side road.
Stunned.
Yeah.
I am stunned. She asked for help. They gave her help, and then she made up this story of being kidnapped because she failed at seducing the husband.
I think that that is exactly what happened. I don't think it's going to be a hot take to tell you that I think that the Hannahs are a much more reliable source of information than Jody, because I just think that that's exactly what happened. I think that she expected to go in and convince them that, like, she was literally fighting demons and stuff like that. And then they saw her, like, stabbing herself with forks and knives.
At that point, though, like, she should be admitted somewhere. Like, she should be getting some psychiatric help after multiple instances of trying to stab yourself.
That's what I think, too. I will also say that Jody can be really persuasive to people that she does know and that she doesn't know. So,
yeah.
It may have also been 2020 by this point, so I'm not sure how easy it would have been to get help for somebody during that time period. That would have been a little bit more tricky during that time than it hopefully is normally. But I do think that you're right. I think that she realized that her scheme wasn't working, and then she was like, well, actually, as it turns out, they kidnapped me?
Yeah.
And so this wasn't my fault. This isn't a crisis of my own making. This is obviously because I'm the victim here. Disgusting. Well,
and I think the fact that she tried to seduce the husband and it was like a failed attempt, she probably felt even more of those like inner feelings of rejection. Because there's no way that you're breaking up these marriages if you don't have your own issues with relationships internally that you're working through. So it's like reinforcing that either she wasn't wanted in the past or someone had abandoned her in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just, it contributes to getting her on this man-hating train and taking vengeance on men.
Yep. 100%. Ruby, at that point, was still worried about her friend slash therapist. So she suggested that she and Kevin could go visit Jody at her house in Ivins. When Kevin and Ruby went to visit Jody, apparently there was some really weird stuff that happened. Think poltergeist or some other generic horror movie with noises happening in random parts of the house and banging and crashing and all that good stuff. Ruby was really worried about Jody, so she begged Kevin to let Jody come live with them. Kevin was exactly 0% interested in that idea, but then both women accused him of being selfish and entitled until he finally relented. When Jody moved into the Frankie house, the spooky, demony nonsense kept happening, and Ruby eventually started sleeping in the same bed as Jody to make sure that she was okay throughout the night.
What was she doing that was convincing them so thoroughly that demons were attacking her?
I think that Kevin was, again, I'm pretty sure that this is happening in like 2020. So I think that like isolation was probably at an all-time high for this family at this period in time. And so Kevin may have been just like the only adult that he knew in this particular circle, a very small circle of adults who was like, what is going on here? And Ruby was just fully invested. She was like, no, I believe Jody. She is my friend. She is my therapist. She wouldn't lie to me. There's clearly stuff going on. I have seen it with my own eyes. And I need to make sure that Jody is making it through the night. And I can do that by sleeping in the same bed as her to make sure that she isn't, I don't know, attacked by a demon in the middle of the night. I don't know what Ruby thought she was going to do, but that was basically what was going on there. If you really want to do a deep dive into Kevin's second interview, you can find some great channels on YouTube that spend over an hour reviewing all of the details, and I will link some of those shows and the actual just plain audio of that second interview in our show notes. But this is already a super long episode, so we are going to move on because honestly, I find the next part of Kevin's interview more weird and ominous than anything else, more so than the spooky
okay.
demony nonsense. So we are going to see a brief reemergence of Pam Botcher from last episode. She was the one who had picked up the Frankie teens from the rec center, and they were found with her when the police came a-knocking on the front door. So Ruby, Jody, and Pam were all kind of like friends slash work colleagues slash therapy partners. I have no idea. And they would all go into a room together for hours at a time to perform some kind of intervention where Jody would receive divine visions.
Of course.
Apparently. Yeah. On one of these occasions, something didn't go according to plan, and Jody did not like that. And so Kevin and Ruby decided that they needed to try an in-home separation, or at least Ruby told Kevin that that was what she wanted. And I'm going to let Kevin tell you a little bit about how that went.
Jody flipped out because during one intervention, Chad was in the backyard with a bunch of friends. And it was my job to keep all the kids contained in the basement watching movies or playing video games. And I took the dog on a walk and I thought they were done, but they weren't done. And Chad had all his high school friends over in the backyard. Jody flipped out. She was ready to come back to Ivan's on her own that night. And Ruby and Pam talked her into staying. But that was the first night where Ruby said, I want a separation from you.
So I think that makes it pretty clear that Ruby and Kevin's separation was very much influenced, at the very least, by Jody.
Yeah. She was upset that their son had people over?
Yep.
For what reason?
Because their noise from the backyard was interfering. You were a guest
in their house.
Yeah, but she's getting divine visions, Naftali.
Okay.
How is she supposed to do that when there's the sound of teen boys outside? Come on. Yeah. No, but it is crazy. That's insane. Let's all chill out here. So Kevin and Ruby continued their separation for 6 months while Jody continued to live in their house. And again, here is another clip from Kevin. This is the last one from this particular interview. But again, I just feel like if I try to explain it, it doesn't sound real.
It was hard. Basically, there were all these rules now placed on me. Like, I could leave when I wanted, but I couldn't come back until Ruby gave me permission. I couldn't come into the kitchen to eat until Ruby gave me permission. And the upstairs where Jody roamed was completely off limits. I couldn't go upstairs anymore in my own house. And there would be Ruby would dictate all of the terms of how our interactions would be, when we would talk, when, and that was hard. And it was during that time that I really became, I would say, dependent upon Ruby. Like, if she said a kind word to me, like, my whole day was made.
It was so sad that he's, like, getting crumbs and he's gobbling them up like it's, like, a feast.
Yeah, I think that in the first episode, I was like, there's no way that I'm going to feel, like, any level of sympathy for Kevin, Frankie, in this situation. Mm-hmm. And then you listen to the second episode. And the thing is, once again, is that I don't think that he made all the good choices by any stretch of the imagination. But I also believe this version of the story. It matches up with what other men have said. I also think that in the way that he presents it and stuff like that, he knows the parts that sound crazy. It doesn't seem like a well-rehearsed story. It just seems like he's reminiscing with the officers and stuff like that. So I don't know. I tend to believe his story. So eventually, in January of 2022, Jody finally moved back to her own 10,000 square foot house in Ivins. But by July of 2022, Ruby asked Kevin to move out of the house. Kevin goes on to explain that he rarely heard from Ruby after that point unless she needed something. And that usually involved money, which, again, he found very strange, but he wasn't really sure what to do about it. So sometimes, like, Jody wanted Ruby to sign over all of the rights to the 8 Passengers channel to Jody. And then Ruby would be like, oh, I want to, like, sell the car or something like that. And I just need you to sign the deed because Jody needs money for this.
It's like a relationship.
It's really weird. It reminds me of a cult.
Yeah.
Where the cult leader's like, I need money from all of you, my followers, my faithful followers. And so can you please make that happen for me?
I cannot receive messages from up above until I am financed.
Yeah, I'm going to need just a little fiver before I can get any divine visions. I have no idea. So kind of coming back to this, there is a lot of controversy around Kevin, and I don't disagree with that controversy. I think that he prioritized the health and well-being of his marriage over the health and well-being of his children, which is not something that I agree with, but it is a message that's pretty commonly shared in conservative Christian communities, so I'm not surprised by it.
I get, like, the put your marriage first and your kids second, because, like, your kids, at the end of the day, theoretically, should be, like, leaving your house, and you should be, like, at least liking the partner that you're with at the end of the day. But while they're young like that, they had, like, youngins, like, fully invested in the kids. Like, I think that was something that I was fully prepared to talk to Cooper about, and we did talk about it the first few years. I was going to be fully invested in raising this child because he is helpless and small, and they had small children who needed functioning parents. There wasn't a lot of time to focus on, like, the relationship.
No.
So I get it to a degree, but, like, when you still have littles who still need functional parents with a functioning household, like, that was not the time to, like, completely go off your rocker separate and play this game of, like, our therapist is gonna live with us but also you don't get to actually, like, you as my spouse don't get to live in this house until I tell you you can live in this house in a very specific way.
There's no way to know whether or not Kevin would have just gone along with the horrific abuse of his children, just like he went along with everything else. I know that Ruby and Kevin were making some very questionable parenting choices even before Jody was this weird, ever-present being in their lives. But I do like to think that Kevin would have drawn the line at some point before his kids were abused in that way. I will also say that there's really no way to know if Kevin is telling the truth. This particular portion of the case is mostly hearsay, and it's totally eclipsed by the magnitude of the crimes against the kids, as it should be. But all that being said, I do believe Kevin. His story matches up with the stories told by so many other men before they came out publicly. And he so perfectly laid out this detailed series of very weird, random events that separated him from his wife and his kids. And we see the way that Jody and Ruby worked to prime him for that separation. We're going to talk about Kevin again at the end of the episode, but we're going to leave him here for now. So now that we understand the first major fracture in the Frankie family, it will be easier to understand how Jody and Ruby were able to isolate and harm the youngest Frankie children without raising any major alarms. They systematically removed every major barrier in their way. Kevin wasn't allowed to contact Ruby unless she reached out to him first. Sherry and Chad had both moved out and were living on their own. And now Jody and Ruby were left as the sole caregivers to the youngest Frankie children, but unfortunately, no care would be given. It seems as though the four youngest Frankie children were together through most of their parents' separation, although as I mentioned earlier, it seems like the teens A and J were still attending school while the two youngest, R and E, were being, quote, homeschooled. If we cast our minds back to the previous episode, we will recall that there were reports of the kids being left home alone for days at a time, prompting the oldest Frankie daughter, Sherry, to call TPS to ask for a welfare check, which went unanswered. I mean, people showed up, but like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Based on the reporting, it seems unclear to me if all four kids were together at these times or if the two younger went with Sherry while the teens stayed at home. I'm just not sure. We do know that the children became separated at some point. When R escaped Jody's house and sought help from the neighbors, he wasn't even entirely sure which siblings were still in the house because he hadn't seen any of his sisters in over a month. So he could only really tell the investigators what he had experienced, but his account was harrowing enough on its own. E took longer to open up, but when she did, she told an equally horrific story. Since the very beginning of the LDS Church, Mormons have been encouraged to journal in some capacity. As technology has advanced, some people went from pen and paper journaling to computer journaling or video journals, blogs, vlogs, but the overall purpose is still the same. Originally, this journaling was encouraged as an act of gratitude, but obviously when you're journaling about your daily life, it's not unusual to find some struggles mixed in with the blessings. While searching Jody's home, investigators found a journal written by Ruby that contained detailed accounts of the abuse of the children, particularly R and E. With Jody, who is often referred to as G-Jo in the writing, heavily implicated throughout the writing. The full 60-page document was shared with the court, though the publicly available version is heavily redacted. Still, there is enough information to give us a rough timeline of the events to paint a picture of the torturous therapy that R and E were forced to participate in. And when I say therapy, it is in major air quotes. So, on May 22nd, 2023, Ruby and her four youngest children traveled from Springville to Jody's home in Ivins to, quote, help spring clean. For most of the rest of May and June, the timeline is redacted, but then on June 30th, Ruby wrote, R refuses to do wall sits. He says he is done. And then on July 1st, she wrote, R is to stay outside, sleep outside, only come in to use the bathroom and shower. It's going to get worse. I'm so sorry. On July 10th, she wrote a more detailed entry. It's R's birthday and he doesn't even know what month it is. E and R have been in so much deviant behavior, they won't control their bodily functions. They are both furious, their selfish and sinful lifestyle is being intervened upon. I told R he emanates a snake. He slithers and sneaks around, looking for opportunities when no one is watching, and then he scurries. If he wants to emanate the Savior, he needs to be 100% obedient with exactness. E is better behaved with Jody. She likes to think that she can still manipulate me. I gave her a pixie haircut. All her long hair is gone. No more distracting with hair. R told me he would rather have a glass of water than me as his mother. And I give, as a side note, a round of applause to R for that statement, because you know what that is? That is a level of self. Yeah, it's a level of self-respect that is not often seen in a 12-year-old. So, go R. We're not close to being done. I'm so sorry.
It's all so sad.
It is sad.
And so, it sounds so hateful.
It does sound, yes, I completely agree. It is uncomfortable to think about a mother describing her kids in this way and talking to her kids in this way. The only
type of mother I can think of describing their kids that way is one that's suffering from actual, like, delusions and hallucinations and things that aren't really there.
I do kind of agree with you. Yeah. On July 11th, Ruby wrote, "Big day for evil. E manipulates me. She won't scream when Jody is around, but with me, she wails. All night, E screamed, cried, and would hit her head on the tile floor. R was told to stand in the sun with his sun hat. He is defiant. R, or I should say his demon, stays in the shade. I push R into the sun. R comes back. I come back with a cactus poker. When I poke his back to get him in the sun, R doesn't even flinch."
So desensitized. What makes me so sad about E is that in every parenting book that I've read, like, when kids are complete monsters with their parents, it's that sense of, like, safety because they know that parents are going to love them regardless. And she's, like, seeking that safety and, like, wanting that attention so badly from her mom. And her mom is dismissing it as, like, evil, not even recognizing that this is her, this is E being vulnerable because she feels like her mom's going to love her regardless. And she doesn't. And that is so sad to me.
It is very sad. So, with all of that in mind, according to U.S. climate data, the average temperature in Ivins during the month of July is 101 degrees average. So all of these entries are interspersed with temporary moments of basic human kindness. And Ruby often reminds her children that she loves them, but also reminds them of how evil and sinful they are.
That is so bizarre. Like, what do you expect to gain from that? Because, I mean, E and R, R's 12. E is...
She was 9 at the time.
They're like, she's like barely understanding the concept of, like, good and evil. And, like, it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like, that's some of the research that is thrown at us as parents. It's like, you don't want them to hear about all the negative things that they do, because then they're going to keep doing it because that's just what you've labeled them as. You want to, like, encourage that they're capable. You want to encourage that they are kind. And 9 is still so young to feel like you're a bad person, that you are inherently bad.
Yeah, it is very young. And she's really not doing anything that is bad. That's the thing. No. I mean,
she just is being labeled that.
Yeah. And when she's like,
who she is now, according to all she's been hearing from her mom.
Yeah. And when she screams and cries and wails and stuff like that, that is a normal human response to horrific situations. Mm-hmm. That's what people do. On July 13th, Ruby wrote, "Jody and Jay are going on a road trip to look at property in Arizona. Ruby has some cash in the bank." So yes, she is referring to herself in the third person. "If the property is right, we can move on financing immediately. We decided the escalation of the kids is not manageable right now. R is now sitting/angry/defiant. E is lying on the floor. We will bring them in. They will think that they won. They will think they got what they wanted. They will relax and then pop. We will drop them like hot potatoes out in the desert. Their new home."
This is worse than, like, parents in the 50s sending their kids to like psych wards.
Yeah. It's pretty horrific. We're done with the direct quotes, and we're going to wrap up this part of the episode soon before my head explodes. There's a lot more in the journal that we're not going to go into on this podcast. I honestly think that they should have redacted even more information, but this gives us an idea of the kind of daily hell that R and E were subjected to. Ruby and Jody also told the kids that they would be taken to jail if they tried to escape, but in mid-July, R tried to run away. By that time, R was spending all of his time outside, including the times when he slept. So he left a message of pebbles near his, quote, bed, saying, jail, I will call when I get there. He ultimately decided that he wanted to choose jail over his continued situation. Unfortunately, Ruby caught up to R a short time later and brought him back to Jody's house. It was at that point that he was restrained to stop him from leaving. Throughout the rest of the journal, Ruby occasionally accuses R and E of, quote, stealing water while showering and brushing their teeth. Investigators also found a container of honey mixed with cayenne pepper powder in Jody's kitchen, and R said that they had used that to treat his wounds that he received from his bindings.
Ow, cayenne pepper?
Yep.
I would, like, maybe, like, if I was super crunchy, be like, yeah, honey is a natural remedy, but with a cayenne pepper.
Honey is a natural antibiotic, and cayenne pepper can be helpful as a health food, but only when it is ingested. And I think that the pepper was only used to hurt rather than help. So, that's gross. In a very gross story.
Mm-hmm.
Just another element of grossness. So this is all pretty awful and horrifying on its own, but prepare to feel even worse because this was not, in fact, the first time that Jody did something like this. In 2009, Jesse, who uses they-them pronouns, was a teen living with their parents and three siblings in California. Jesse grew up in a traditional Mormon household with their dad acting as the provider and their mom acting as the homemaker. Jesse believed in the church, but they were also curious about other religions and ways of life. And as they entered their teen years, Jesse had a lot of questions that weren't exactly welcomed in their church or in their home. As time went on, Jesse started to have a lot of issues with their parents, and they became more anxious and started running away on a regular basis. When Jesse was 15, they and their family went to Utah to visit their grandparents for their 50th wedding anniversary. While there, Jesse got into an argument with their mom because they didn't want to do the dishes. So Jesse's mom took away their phone. Jesse went down to the basement to sleep off their annoyance, and a while later, they awoke to the sound of a knock at the door. When they opened the door, they saw their grandparents and their aunt, Jody Hildebrandt.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering where, like, Jesse was related to all of this. Okay.
Yep. Jody told Jesse that their family had left to return to California, and Jesse was going to be living with Jody for a while.
Wait, Jody came with Jesse's grandparents?
Yeah, so okay. They were the ones who, like, met Jesse at the door.
Got it, okay. And Jody is Jesse's
aunt.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse was obviously upset, but Jody didn't give them any time to mourn the departure of their family. Jody started by cutting off all of Jesse's hair and then forbidding them from wearing makeup or their own clothing. Jesse wasn't allowed to go to school or do anything without Jody's permission. Step by systematic step, Jody tried to remove all traces of Jesse's identity.
Aww.
Here is an excerpt from an interview with Jesse featured on KUTV2.
The things that I experienced while living with Jody, I experienced being tied, I experienced being duct taped, I experienced being blindfolded, I experienced severe isolation, I experienced severe emotional, spiritual, and psychological abuse. I experienced the being told I shouldn't be around other people, being told that I was dangerous to be around. People were afraid of me to the point where I was afraid of myself. I was forced to sleep outside in the snow. I was Like I said, isolated for up to 12 hours a day. If someone spoke to me directly, if I wasn't wearing duct tape on my mouth, I had to just stare at them and not respond, because she also had systems of people that would report back to her if I broke any of these rules. And her whole thing, which is deeply, darkly ironic, is that everything stems from shame and how horrible shame is. And that all of the reason, like all of mental illness, all tics, so like OCDs, addiction, everything stems from shame, which is just horrifying, because she is the greatest perpetuator of shame. She also, and this is like a very deep connection and why I chose to come forward to the media rather than just staying with the podcast. She accused me of being a sex addict. She accused me of being addicted to masturbation, to the point where I wasn't allowed to, I mentioned this on the podcast, to the point where I wasn't allowed to use tampons. I never was allowed privacy unless I was isolated. So that included the bathroom. I was never allowed to have the door closed, because she was convinced that I was just constantly masturbating. She was convinced that I was addicted to porn. I had never seen porn at that point in my life. I didn't even know that people with my anatomy could masturbate. Like I had no idea any of this stuff, but I just believed her, because she, everything, like one, she used religion and God as a mode of control. And a mode to manipulate. And so I just believed all of these things. So her ability to convince you of these neuroticisms and these behaviors is, and I was a teenager. And so a child in that position of being told this over and over and over and over again, which I'm certain he was, stood no chance. She also, because of what the abuse and torturing that was going on, and the belief that she had that I was doing something more. So her rationale to the severity of these punishments and this physical and emotional abuse was, she wanted to make my life, and this is like her quote, like this is what she would tell me all of the time. She wanted to make my life so uncomfortable that it would force the sin out, that it would force me to confess. So things continuously got worse and worse and progressively more and more intense as a way to get me to confess, because she believed that if I had confessed everything, if all of my sins were out and in the open, that I would be getting better. And I was declining sick, like very fast, exponentially. And so she just kept ramping it up.
So as you can see, Jesse laid out a really very classic manipulation, like brainwashing, the destruction of a person's identity until they comply and everything like that. Like, well, exactly that happened.
What she said, shame. Yep. It was all shame based, breaking down their self-worth, self-image, classic abuser behavior.
Very classic. Also, classic cult leader behavior. Just saying. Jesse tried to run away a couple of times, and every time things got worse. Jody took Jesse to work every single day and made them wait in a silent room while Jody met with clients. One day, one of Jody's coworkers saw Jesse in the room yet again, and when they asked Jody why there was this teen child sitting in the room for hours on end, Jody became very defensive, and this coworker became very worried about Jesse. And so the coworker just left a coat hanging in the room one day because she knew it was cold. And Jesse took that as their sign that it was time to run. And so they did. In March of 2010, Jesse went to the American Fork Police and told them about the incidents and requested a referral to a safe house. And that was provided.
Oh, good.
Jesse contacted the police with their story when they learned that Jody had been arrested for what she had done to the Frankie children. Jesse's story so closely matched the accounts shared by R&E, and this was before it even made national news, so it was easy to believe, and it demonstrated a pattern that spanned over a decade. I am glad that Jesse did come forward despite the fact that no one believed them way back when this happened to them in 2009-2010. I think that they would have been well within their rights to be like, you didn't listen to me then, why would you listen to me now? But they did come forward and they were like, I can tell you that this isn't the first time that Jody has done this. And that's helpful in the investigation, because on top of all of the other evidence, it just completely corroborates everything that E and R reported. So,
well, and Jesse came out with the information again at a really good time, before all the details were disclosed to media, so that it wasn't like,
yes,
oh, you're just very conveniently sharing this after the fact. It was like, no, I have this information because it happened to me. I am assuming this happened to these kids too.
Yep. Yeah. And Jesse at one point did make kind of an allusion to Ruby accusing one of her kids of some pretty horrific, gross stuff. That is just not true. It's just not true. I'm not going to even share that information because I'm not going to, I'm just not going to perpetuate a lie. And I don't even think that Ruby would stick with that at this point in time.
Such a disgusting type lie too. Like,
I don't think that Ruby thought it was a lie when she said it in court. I think she knows it is now.
Yeah.
But I don't think that she did when she said it.
Brainwashing.
It is the brainwashing. And on that note, the question that we have to ask ourselves is why? Why the manipulation? Why the abuse? Why is Jody unable to let go of clients who don't like her counseling style? Does she really believe that she's being stalked by shadow figures? Does she really think that the devil is after her? Does she really think that she's helping people? Or is it all about power and control? I don't think it's a mystery what I think. Okay, so Jody won't come right out and admit to anything, but I have my personal theories. Jody, as I have mentioned many times throughout this episode, reminds me of a cult leader. So we covered the Aggressive Christianity Missionary Training Corps in episode 90 of this podcast. And in that episode, we looked at common traits of cult leaders and how they operate. So let's take a quick look at some of those factors and compare them with this case. So these are kind of the main personality traits of a cult leader. They're charismatic. Check. They're narcissistic. I don't think that she's been diagnosed, but I have a guess. They are dominant over their followers.
Yes.
They are exploitative of their followers, asking people to give them money or belongings, forcing them to work for little or no pay, having them accommodate you living in their house for months at a time, etc.
Controlling their children and who they hang out with and what hours are allowed to be children.
Yep. They are manipulative. Check, 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 check. So many checks.
So many. Bold, underlined, highlighted.
Yes, absolutely. Many are sociopaths and psychopaths. Again, there is no clinical diagnosis that I'm aware of, but I have my guesses. And they are unpredictable, which is just another method that they use to maintain control. And here are kind of the ways that they pull people into their sphere of influence. To start with, they invite new followers. For example, they might invite them to a connections conference, if you will. Then they love bomb them and they tell them all of the reasons that they're great and why they need to be there and why it's so important. Then they get their other followers to sell the lifestyle. Once someone has bought whatever bullshit they're selling, then they begin cracking down.
Pyramid scheme.
Yes, 100%.
The recruitment process is a pyramid scheme.
It really reminds me of like a pyramid scheme or, forgive me, an MLM.
MLM, like, yes.
Yeah, 100%. So once they begin cracking down, they know that it's time to isolate their followers. And then after that, they begin a slow indoctrination of core beliefs. And then they set a total ban on criticism of their policies, their behaviors, or anything like that. So I actually have written in my script here, Jody reminds me a bit more of an MLM leader than your typical, like, stereotypical, like, Jim Jones, Charles Manson cult leader. But I still think that the overall idea of, like, this cult-like mentality and this cult-like control is very much present. I don't think that everybody's going to agree with me about that, but that is how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And what about Ruby? I tend to believe that Ruby was already on the edge when she met Jody and when Jody started exerting all of this control over her. Mormon children are expected to obey their parents, but the church has publicly condemned physical punishment and abuse for many years at this point. I don't know if Ruby was already inclined to be a strict parent, and to be honest, I do think that she was, but I'm also wondering if the public criticism that she received from her Eight Passengers channel just made her totally unhinged, especially when it looked like she was going to lose it all because of her controversial parenting style.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So with all that in mind, let's get back to where we left Jody and Ruby as they awaited their court appearances from jail. The women appeared in separate hearings for the first time on September 8, 2023. They both faced 6 counts of aggravated child abuse. Each count carries a sentence of 1 to 15 years in prison and fines of up to $10,000. Based on the severity of the charges against them, bail was denied.
Good. Yes.
Ruby was devastated to be kept from Jody when she first arrived at Purgatory Correctional Facility.
There was, it's such an odd, like, romance almost.
Yes, I agree.
Like, taking away a spouse. Like, she was so dependent on her, so intimately, emotionally connected with her, that it's borderline, like, partner level, like romantic partner.
I fully agree with you. And we are not the only people to have said that. I have seen that being mentioned by other people who have really like dived into this case as well. It's bizarre is what I'll say. I don't understand what happened. I don't necessarily believe that there was like any level of physical intimacy between them. But that, like, emotional intimacy was there in some capacity. And I also don't think that that's that unusual, again, in the case of, like, a cult leader with their follower. So, you know, all of this is kind of, it's just weird. I don't pretend to understand it. As the months went by and Ruby spent more time away from her former therapist slash friend slash colleague, Ruby started to have a change of heart and began to process the full weight of her actions.
Wow.
Yes. On December 18th, 2023, Ruby appeared in court once again, but this time she was there to accept a strict plea deal of 3 counts of felony child abuse in exchange for her admittance of guilt and her testimony against Jody. Ruby shared a statement in court accepting full responsibility for her actions. If you can handle it, I would recommend checking out the full statement, and it will be linked in our show notes. But I wanted to share a quick clip for now.
Any intent to change my stipulated sentence? For the past 4 years, I've chosen to follow counsel and guidance that has led me into a dark delusion. My distorted version of reality went largely unchecked, as I would isolate from anyone who challenged me. I was led to believe that this world was an evil place, filled with cops who control, hospitals that injure, government agencies that brainwash, church leaders who lie and lust, husbands who refuse to protect, and children who need abused. My choice to believe and behave this paranoia culminated into criminal activity, for which I stand before you today, ready to take accountability. Jody Hildebrandt was never my business partner, nor was I ever employed by her. I have never received wages from her or connections. Jody was employed as my son's counselor in 2019, and in 2020, I paid her to be my mentor. It is important to me to demonstrate my remorse and regret without blame. I take full accountability for my choices, and it is my preference that I serve a prison sentence. Thank you to the officers in Santa Clara and the Ivan City Police. You were the angels who came and saved my children. I especially want to thank Detective Jade Bate. She plucked me out of a situation I didn't know how to get out of. And the moment she handcuffed me was the moment I gained my freedom. You were not the controlling ones. I was. Thank you to the medical staff at Intermountain Hospital. Your skill, tenderness, and professionalism helped heal my children. Jody and I inflicted the injuries, not the hospital. Thank you to DCFS, the Children's Justice Center, Judge Basil, and other key adults. You've gathered my children under your wing and offered them love, compassion, encouragement. You were not the ones who were doing the brainwashing. Thank you to my Bishop Tom Hawks and my state president, Jim Nelson, for reminding me of the Lord's love for the lost. So much pain and suffering would have been avoided had I followed and heeded your counsel. I was the one who was deceived, not you. Thank you to the Washington County Prosecutor's Office. My charges are just. They offer safety to my family, accountability to the public, and they did show mercy to me. Thank you to my attorney, Lamar Winward, and his staff. I would not be where I am today without them. Thank you to Randy Kester for your limitless energy in healing my family. My dear friends, Pam and Roy, I'm so sorry for letting you down. Because of your association with me, your innocence was called into question. My mother-in-law, father-in-law, Kevin's family, my cousins, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and neighbors, you all saw the warning signs long before I did, and you did what you could. You wanted to help, but I pushed you away. My mother and father, I have been utterly wretched to you. You have offered me unconditional love, and for that, I have offered you unconditional contempt. My siblings and their spouses, because of my decision to roll around in a pigsty, I've dragged your families through the mud in public. Yet, when I desired to return as the prodigal sister, unlike the prodigal's brother in the Bible, you synced step with my parents and ran out to greet me. Your capacity to love is unprecedented. Kevin, my husband of more than 23 years, you are the love of my life. I'm so sorry to leave to you to finish what we both started together. The ending of our marriage is a tragedy. And you are wrapped around my heart in a knot I'll never be able to undo. To my babies, my six little chicks, you are part of me. I was the mama duck who was consistently waddling you to safety. I can see now that over the past 4 years, I was in a deep undercurrent that led us to danger. I would never have led you to darkness knowingly. I was so disoriented that I believed dark was light and right was wrong. I would do anything in this world for you. My willingness to sacrifice all for you was masterfully manipulated into something very, very ugly. I took from you all that was soft and safe and good. I took from you your mother. How terrifying this must have been for you. I will never stop crying for hurting your tender souls. You are each so precious to me. I'm sorry. My choice to live in fear of the world has created a great vulnerability and a blind spot for me, where I have broken hearts and I've caused people to suffer and I have betrayed sacred trust. Watching my community respond to my barges, with justice and mercy and grace and love is all the more evidence to me of how wrong I've been. This world is full of really good people. And finally, I'm sorry for twisting God's word and distorting his doctrines. My greatest desire is to stand in his court someday spotless and confident. And Judge Walton, I know that standing before you today is a necessary step towards that end. Thank you to you and your staff for facilitating my opportunity to take accountability and to answer for my charges. I am humbled and willing to serve a prison sentence as long as it takes to continue unraveling all of this information I have believed and bought, swallowed, and acted out, and for my family to heal and for the community to heal. And I understand this is going to take time. I'm committed to continuing my learning until all of my toxic layers are shed and I am ready to re-enter as a contributing member of our beautiful society. Thank you, Judge Walton.
Thank you for your statement.
I honestly think that Jody would have fought the charges against her, but when Ruby accepted her plea deal, Jody followed suit just over a week later on December 27th, 2023. Though Ruby seems to accept responsibility for her actions, Jody seems a little less apologetic. And when I say a little, I mean a lot. I am not going to share the audio clip because I don't want to spend any more time searching for Jody on the internet than I already have done. But here's what she said. Quote, I sincerely love these children. I desire for them to heal physically and emotionally. One of the reasons I did not go to trial is I did not want them to emotionally relive the experience, which would have been detrimental to them. My hope and prayer is that they will heal and move forward to have beautiful lives. I'm willing to submit to what the state feels would be an appropriate amount of time served to make retribution as an outcome. And that is it in its entirety. That's the whole statement. Like I said, it's a lot less responsibility, I feel like, accepted in her statement.
Yeah, it felt very superficial. Like, she hit the points and was like, all right, no more fluff. I don't know. Not that fluff means disingenuous or that it's more genuine, but it just felt like bare minimum.
Yeah. Yep. I think it's that I see this in, like, the two sentences. What Ruby said is, I am humbled and willing to serve a prison sentence as long as it takes to continue unraveling all of this information I have believed and bought and swallowed and acted out, and for my family and the community to heal. And then Jody says, I'm willing to submit to what the state feels would be an appropriate amount of time served to make retribution as an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those two statements show a lot of difference in
personal one responsibility another. And your part in what happened.
Yes. Ultimately, both women can spend up to 30 years in prison, and it will be up to the Utah Parole Board to decide when they will be paroled. I think that for the time being, they are both where they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about the most important thing in this case. Where are the Frankie children today? R and E were placed together in a foster home. According to investigators, both of the children are doing much better and seem to be recovering remarkably well. We don't know where A and J are, so I'm guessing that they've also been placed in some sort of foster care, but those records are private. When police searched the Frankie family home on August 30th, 2023, Sherry was permitted to enter the house to gather some clothes and other items for her younger sisters. At the time, Kevin Frankie considered filing charges of burglary against his oldest child for her entry into the house, but he soon abandoned that particularly awful idea. Thank goodness. By October of 2023, less than 2 months after the arrests, Kevin began the process of reconciliation with Sherry and Chad and started to fight for custody of his four youngest children. In November, Kevin filed for divorce from Ruby. As I mentioned in the last episode, and a little bit earlier in this one as well, I think that Kevin is the most controversial figure in this case, and I completely understand why. To be honest, even after this long, in-depth research, I'm still not sure what I think of Kevin. Even before he met Jody, he and Ruby made parenting choices that I don't think I'd make, but that could be said for any number of parents out there, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they are unfit parents. Ruby obviously is, but I honestly don't know about Kevin. I think that there should be a major vetting process before the state decides whether or not to give Kevin the opportunity to regain custody of his children, and then, if he is found fit to parent again, I think that each child should have a say in whether they choose to remain with their foster families or whether they return to live with their dad. And they should be able to make those decisions without Kevin in the room so they don't feel like pressured to say, yes, I want to live with him or not.
Mm-hmm.
Despite what any one of us may think of Kevin, we know that parental separation is very hard on children. And if Kevin can pull it together to be the dad that his kids deserve, then I think that they should also have a say in whether or not that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So despite the mountain of evidence in this case, I still have a lot of unanswered questions, as I'm sure a lot of people do. Why did R and E seem to receive such harsh treatment? Were the teens exposed to similar levels of abuse? Did Jody really believe her spiritual nonsense, or is she just a narcissist hungry for power and control? And did Ruby really believe in her, or did Jody just provide some sort of justification for Ruby's harsh parenting style? I'm not sure about any of those questions. Sorry. I honestly think that one of the ways that Ruby can show continued contrition for her actions is to work with people to really identify what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that it's important in understanding how we got from like this seemingly normal family. And I think that they were normal for a long time. Again, they made parenting choices that I wouldn't make, but I could say that about anybody, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we would all act differently in different situations, and it doesn't mean that their family wasn't altogether fairly normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ended up on a podcast and a million podcasts and a thousand different, you know, news channels. And there are going to be documentaries about this. And I think that it's just important to know how we got from point A to point Z on a different alphabet, because we could learn from it. And I think that we need to be able to learn from this. So I have no idea, but hopefully we'll figure out more as time goes on. What are your thoughts?
I think Ruby has a really good chance of self-improvement and rehabilitation, getting a lot of good like self-efficacy rebuilt back up. She shows a really solid foundation of accountability, and I think she genuinely wants to continue her journey of self-improvement. So I'm happy for that journey for her. I really, like you said, would like to know, like, what was the breaking point, the weak point that really led someone like Ruby to be led astray, to be so easily convinced into this path of darkness, according to Ruby? And how can we learn from that with women who are in maybe struggling relationships or overwhelmed with parenting and need that support, need that assistance from people who genuinely believe in the mental health practice, not someone who's manipulating, and how to identify that too, because they are a vulnerable population. And I think Jody's victims were so easily accessible to her because they came to her for help and they were already extremely vulnerable, and she just picked that apart. Classic abuser, classic cult leader. So further understanding Ruby's journey, I think, would help. And like, I don't want to like learn more about Jody's psyche for the purpose of giving her the attention, but there is value to it as far as like her motivations and how to identify that too in others. So Ruby, I think, is on a really good path. Jody, I don't think if she's that true narcissist, is ever going to really learn. It's just how to keep her from being harmful again.
Yeah. If what Ruby said during her, you know, plea agreement, her statement was accurate, then I agree with you. I think that she has a real possibility of making improvements to herself and maybe even the possibility of making some progress in the relationship with her kids in the mm-hmm. eventual future if they choose to try to contact her again in the future. But as you say, I don't know about Jody if she seems particularly likely to improve herself. We'll see. I'll be curious to see, you know, what the parole process looks like. And as we both said, I really do hope that something at least can be learned from this. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, we can figure out a lot more about what was ticking in both of these particular brains to make this happen.
Yeah. I think my concern with Kevin is his parenting style if he does get custody back. Because yes, it is extremely important that the kids have a say in like if they feel comfortable going back to him. But also, what is your parenting plan for them? Because if it in any way, shape, or form has elements of control like it did before, that could be so detrimental to their healing and triggering to like their trauma and experiences with Ruby and Jody, that even if he's not as toxic as before in their perception, because again, different parenting choices, again, I wouldn't do that, but it could be perceived as general toxicity, not like not abusive, but toxic to some people. I won't say if it's me or not, but it could still be controlling enough that it's not beneficial for the kids to stay with him if he continues down that avenue of really strict parenting. So I'm not saying he shouldn't get custody of his kids, but it's definitely something hopefully Child Services is thinking about and something he's willing to like explore, because they have all this new trauma now that that they should be responsive to.
I will say that Kevin filed a lawsuit against Jody to block the sale of her house because he wants to use the proceeds from the sale of that house to be able to fund counseling for his kids.
Oh, that's a really good step.
Yeah. So I do agree with you. I think that there should be, as I said, a thorough vetting process. And based off of the fact that Kevin does want custody of his children and he has not yet been granted custody of his children, I'm thinking that the state of Utah is going through a very thorough vetting process before they even consider it as a possibility. So that gives me hope that they weren't just like, oh, well, you're the parent, so here mm-hmm. you go. Here are your kids back without any plan or anything like that. And the fact that he did file that lawsuit tells me that he knows that his kids need counseling. And I think that after something like this, that people are probably going to continue checking in on them pretty frequently, mm-hmm. even if everything seems to be going well. So that is my hope. And yeah. Then, as you say, I think that that counseling process, I hope, will be a joint process. Family yeah. counseling would be helpful.
I also think looping in the older kids mm-hmm. to share their experiences of when you parented us this way, this was the outcome, and now there's this extra layer for our younger siblings, and I will advocate for them. Because it sounds like Sherry was already trying to do that and like be there for her younger siblings, and I don't foresee her backing off of that anytime soon. So I'm glad that they're getting reinvolved with their younger siblings and trying to help them move along the process. And I hope that Kevin is open and willing to loop them into that.
Yeah, they have been seen leaving court together and like laughing and joking and stuff like that. Kevin and the two oldest kids have.
Chad and mm-hmm. Sherry.
Chad and Sherry. So we'll see where that all goes. And if we ever find out, you know, at the end of the day, I think that the kids deserve privacy, and I'm not sure that we will know. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. If we do find out, you know, what happens, then I will try to provide that update. And I just hope that the Frankie kids can all kind of live their lives as normally as possible after
it's
something
still
like
so
this.
So fresh. Not even a year since it all started going down. So I would expect not to get true, like, their perspective, their updates for a few years, hopefully.
Yeah. And I don't I don't need them to update me. That's their lives.
It is.
You know? Yeah. I just hope the best for them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was a very long two-parter on Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt. And next week, we will be back with another true crime case. Until next time, bye.
Bye.
If you liked the show, please leave us a great review and don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Wicked Within Podcast.